Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard through the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, Representative Jason Chaffetz says that he won't run for re-election in 2018 and may even leave Congress earlier than that. Also, Huntsman Cancer Institute CEO Mary Beckerle is unexpectedly fired, and the American Lung Association gives Salt Lake City's air quality a failing grade. Those stories, plus your underplayed stories of the week and more. And joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is on the phone. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod is here. Good morning, Emma.
Morning.
Health and education reporter Alex Stuckey, thanks to you for being here as well.
Morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com or calling us at 855-855-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's start, Thomas Burr, with you today. Representative Jason Chaffetz on Wednesday said that he would not be seeking re-election or running for anything in 2018. What is the reason that Chaffetz gives for that decision?
You know, I think that was a pretty big surprise for all of us. I personally had expected him to run for the Senate in 2018 against Orrin Hatch if he ran again. So this was a little bit of a stunning move in Utah political circles. But the reasoning he's been given, giving all of us, is it's essentially family, that he's tired of, traversing back and forth between D.C. and Utah. Sleeping on his cot in his office. He's now 50 years old. He said he made this decision on his 50th birthday and decided that he doesn't really want to wake up every morning on a cot and go back and forth to Utah all the time. There's also some other things playing part of this. It sounds like there may be a TV gig in the offering, so that could have come down. We don't know yet what that is. He wouldn't confirm that either, but there's a possibility there. And, the other part of this is he may actually step down early. As we reported yesterday that he's not only not going to run again, he's going to maybe step down in a month or two.
Why the rush to get out? Saying that he's going to leave Congress that soon. Why would he want to get out as quickly as that, as opposed to finishing out his term?
There's a couple reasons, it sounds like. One is, if there is a job offering, right, they're not going to maybe sit around for another 18 months or whatever it would be to wait for him to finish out his term. Secondly, he's been in a pretty tight spot, somewhat of his own making, because of the criticism of him not investigating enough the presidency of Donald Trump, the business ties, the Russia concern, and there's really no way to win in some ways for him, because if he starts investigating Trump, he loses support of the Trump base. There is one in Utah. If he doesn't do enough, then he's going to continue to have all these calls that he's not doing his job. So in one way, if he gets out now, he kind of saves a little bit of having to be in that rock and hard spot.
If he does leave, let's talk about the speculation about what he's going to do. You said a TV gig. Would that preclude... he's dropped some hints about doing something in 2020, a.k.a. running for the governorship here in Utah. Is that something that would get in the way? Would a TV gig get in the way of that? Or I guess it could benefit that as well.
It could benefit that, yeah. He was very clear in his statement in my conversations with him that when he said he's not running in 2018, that didn't preclude another race later on. And I think we've all known that he's also been interested in running for governor, so that would be in 2020. So very much the door is open there. And the TV gig, if he does get one, a national, like a network, something or other, MSNBC, Fox, something like that, it keeps him out there. And it allows him to still be in the public eye, to still be making, headlines and maybe what he says. Because you don't necessarily want to, just go to the private sector and never be heard from again if you're going to run for office. It also keeps him in a prime spot to raise money later on, because he'll be his name ID will still be very high.
Mm. Well, we know there's a job opening at Fox News after the departure of Bill O'Reilly. is that what we're talking about here? Maybe not.
No, we were joking, though, that the idea that he... he stepped down and talked about what he was going to do next, and Bill O'Reilly resigns the same day, or was fired, I guess I should say. So I don't think there's any corollary there, and they've already given the slot to Tucker Carlson.
Okay. If Chaffetz does leave his seat early, what happens to that seat, to the vacant seat?
So that's a little up in the air. The Utah Constitution, pretty much the Utah law, says that the governor will call a special election, but it lays out like zero process for how that's going to take place. So say he steps down in May, the governor can call a special election, but there could be, you know, 30 candidates who run, and we're not sure, do they go through a convention process? Can they get on the ballot through signatures? It's really unclear, so the legislature is going to have to address that. Otherwise, you end up with, I think it's been called a jungle election, where if you have 30 candidates, you could have somebody who wins a congressional seat with, you know, like 11-12% of the vote.
Well, we know that there's a Democrat who's already begun her campaign for that specific seat. Originally, she was, of course, planning to run against Jason Chaffetz, but I guess a question that I have here is could his stepping aside be making it easier for any specific candidate to take on that seat from the GOP side?
Well, from the GOP side, I think there's no shortage of how many people are going to run. We've heard from a lot of people, including, you know, maybe Evan McMullen, the mayor of Provo, John Curtis. I think there's no shortage. Kirk Bramble, the senator from Provo, the state senator, is interested as well. It could make it easy because it's an open seat versus having to try to take somebody out in a convention. But then you also have the problem of if there's a huge field trying to, you know, get your message across to everyone. And when it comes to Dr. Catherine Allen, who has raised $500,000, which is pretty stunning, she's a Democrat. Excuse me. And she's really, really raised her money by being the anti-Chaffetz candidate. She's getting some attention from, like, you know, Rachel Maddow. Now, it becomes a little harder to raise money when you're not the anti-Chaffetz. You're just the I want to, you know, win a congressional seat because you kind of lose a little of the pizzazz there.
You know, I want to circle back around to the speculation for governor and 2020 and potentially Chaffetz getting involved in that. Yesterday, we learned also that Governor Gary Herbert, who previously has said that this will be his last term, said that actually maybe he will run again. Echoes kind of Senator Orrin Hatch there. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, I want to get your comments on, well, both on the Chaffetz announcement and the news that Governor Herbert might run again. Robert Gerke.
Well, I do think that I don't see Governor Herbert running again for another term. That would be extremely, well, obviously unprecedented, but it would be a big surprise as well. And I think there's plenty of people already lining up that would have their eye on that seat, including his lieutenant governor, Spencer Cox.
Well, was he kind of joking when
I think he was maybe being a little facetious, but the Chaffetz announcement was, I think, a surprise to most of us. I mean, he had just won re-election last November, was just starting this term, and was, you know, had sort of laid out his goals for this term already, and so for him to then pull the ripcord and jump out was pretty surprising. I think Tommy hit on a lot of the reasons why he might do this, and there were, you know, there was apparently, talking to people who are close to him, some burnout, some concern or frustration, I guess, with the early stages of this Trump administration. And I think potentially, and I, again, this is sort of maybe me speculating here, but I think having seen some of, you know, the early months of the work that the House Oversight Committee is doing, he kind of sees where this is going, and this is going to be another 2 years of pretty much constant investigative work being done by this committee, or at least questions being raised about the Trump administration's dealings. And so he was going to have a full plate of things that he was either going to have to A, investigate, or B, sweep under the rug. And neither of those are necessarily, you know, good options for him. So this is, you know, in some ways, this makes quite a bit of sense.
Well, and also, Robert,
Roger, I know you're asking the questions, but maybe I could jump in and
sure,
ask.
Sure, please.
Gerke's speculating.
Yeah.
Gerke's speculating. Do you think this would be the case if Hillary Clinton had won? Because it'd be a much different job, it seems.
No, I think that's true, and I think it would be a higher profile position for him, and maybe a less and one that he could still score points here at home, because, you know, we were talking about his ambition to run for governor, perhaps, and so, you know, if he's investigating Hillary Clinton for the next 3 years, that's that puts him in the headlines, it puts him on the TV shows, it puts him in a high-profile position that he can then use to sort of propel his 2020 bid. If he's investigating Donald Trump, or, as I mentioned, you know, on the flip side, maybe sweeping things under the rug for Donald Trump, that doesn't necessarily engender the kind of support that he would be looking for here in Utah, and it doesn't. It's not, I think, what he would like to be doing for the next couple of years. So you know, and I think in some ways it kind of makes sense. I think he does need to make some money. These members of Congress are not paupers, but they're not exactly paid well either. I mean, they're not, you know, raking it in. So you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for him to make this decision. I'm just, again, going back to the timing of it, though, that's what's sort of unusual about it, is just because he had so recently won re-election and just started this term.
Well, I'm thinking about the town halls that have been contentious for elected officials in recent months in the wake of the presidential election, actually. Mm-hmm. Chaffetz faced down some unhappy constituents here in Salt Lake City. Could that be playing into this maybe a little bit?
Well, and it kind of goes to what I was saying about, you know, he was going to be hearing from people if he turned into Donald Trump's lapdog or his lackey. You know, he was going to be hearing from people for the next 19 months, and in a manner probably very similar to what we saw at his town hall, with the shouting and the chanting of do your job, and the calls for him to actually conduct thorough investigations. And so I think they're, you know, that was the future he was looking for the next, at least, you know, year and a half.
How crowded is this field of contenders? I mean, we've got among the people mentioned, Evan McMullen.
Yeah.
The Tribune interviewed a few people who were.
I think it'll shake out a little bit. I think here's what you've got two tiers of people, I think, at this point. And I think McMullen maybe falls into that top tier. I think State Senator Deidre Henderson has been angling for this job, or had her eye on this job for a long time. She's a close confidant of Chaffetz's and has ran his campaign initially. And so I think she has her eye on it. She's probably in that top tier. I think Greg Hughes, if he decides he's interested in this, and from what I'm hearing, he is getting more interested in it, I suppose, is the way to put it.
As opposed to the governorship.
As opposed to the governorship for him. Because, you know, it's unusual to have an open house seat, you know, and so so it's an open seat, it's a special election, which makes it maybe more attractive, and then the governor's race in 2020 now is looking like it's going to be Spencer Cox, you're going to have Josh Romney, you're going to have Jason Chaffetz in there. That's a crowded field on the Republican side of things, and it could be tough. And if Orrin Hatch runs again in 2018, that sort of makes that backlog for that House seat and for that governorship even worse, because all these people who are, all these Republicans who are ambitious, are going to have fewer options to go to. So I think it's going to be a crowded field. And then you've got, you know, the Kurt Brambles and the John Curtises as well. And so it's going to be a logjam.
Quickly on the Democratic side, what does that look like for governor? And we know about the Chaffetz, the maybe open House seat. He might not step down early, but
I think he'll step down early.
Okay.
I'm hearing probably sometime next month, but he may stick around until August.
But for running for governor 2020 on the Democrat side, it seems like a long ways off to be having this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's probably a little early. I mean, I think the Democrats would love to have Ben McAdams run for governor, but, you know, aside from that, they have a pretty shallow depth as potential candidates for that.
Okay, well, in the meantime, some political upheaval here in Utah. We are going to have to actually leave it there and head to a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back after a couple of messages.
What's your compulsion? That thing you can't stop doing?
In Estee Lauder's case, she'd do makeovers on people in elevators, trains. I mean, she cannot stop touching faces.
Repeat when necessary. The upside of compulsion. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI.
Join us Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
We want to know what you think about UPR. We have a new listener survey up and running. It's on our website, upr.org. We hope you'll take just a few minutes to fill out the survey. You'll be able to tell us your favorite programs, what issues you'd like to see covered, and ways we can improve our service. The link is on our website, upr.org. That's upr.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune health and education reporter Alex Stuckey, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, environment reporter Emma Penrod, and columnist Robert Gerke. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Well, from upheaval in politics to upheaval at a renowned Utah institution, the Huntsman Cancer Institute, Alex Stuckey, the Cancer Research Hospital's CEO, was unceremoniously dismissed after 12 years on the job, and that led to some backlash from staff and from others. This is Mary Beckerle that we're talking about. Tell us when and how she was let go, and if you can, why?
Well, I got a call early Tuesday morning from a faculty member who was pretty up in arms about this. So I actually went over to Huntsman Cancer Institute and ran into Mary walking down the hallway. And, you know, I had gotten the email that was sent to faculty the day after she was fired. So this was Monday. Mm-hmm. You know, it just said that she was leaving her position. She'd been there for 11 years. And she's very, you know, she was on Vice President Biden's Blue Ribbon panel for the Cancer Moonshot. I mean, she's very well respected across the country. And what she told me when I ran into her in the hallway was she, at about 3:15 on Monday, she got an email from President Pershing's office that said, you know, sorry to send this to you in an email, and then her termination letter was attached, effective immediately. So people were pretty upset.
inside of the Huntsman Cancer Institute, but also among some high quarters, in particular, John Huntsman Sr. was unhappy, and he unleashed in interviews both with the Tribune, Deseret News, and others on the University of Utah, and in particular on Vivian Lee, who is the head of health sciences at the University of Utah. Tell us about that part of the story.
Yeah, he's pretty unhappy. He, you know, says there's going to be lawsuits, that he's going to get Mary back in no matter what. You know, he has some pull, obviously. The Huntsman Cancer Foundation is responsible for about a third of the institute's operating budget. So that's pretty large chunk. And it's kind of weird because they were negotiating a funding deal, like a new funding agreement. And on Monday, according to Peter Huntsman, Pershing was supposed to fly to Houston to basically just sign the deal. There was already a verbal agreement, apparently. And about the time he was supposed to get on the plane and about the time they informed Mary that she was fired, he sent an email to Peter Huntsman saying, "I'm not coming. By the way, we fired Mary." So even the Huntsmans had no idea. They say that this was happening.
What does the university, you know, U of U President David Pershing and Vivian Lee, what do they say about the reasoning behind this?
Well, they're not talking, and we had to wait until Wednesday to get a comment from the university. And, you know, before they were just saying it's a personnel matter. But so they released a statement just saying, like, we put a lot of thought into this, you know, moving forward. This is not a direct quote, but moving forward, we want more collaboration between the institute and the university.
Can I ask about what is the relationship between the Huntsman Cancer Institute and the University of Utah? Are they separate entities? Are they one and the same?
So they seem separate. You know, they have a separate PR department. But university researchers work at Huntsman. If you're at the U and you have cancer, like, you can go to the Huntsman Cancer Institute. And it operates within University of Utah Healthcare. So it's sort of separate, but not really. It obviously, because Vivian Lee could fire Mary you know, they're within the system.
Right.
So.
Well, I'm just thinking about this from the perspective of the University of Utah being a public institution. And when it comes to, maybe I'm not so certain about personnel matters, but when it comes to decisions like this, will that information, the reason for this firing decision, have to come out as a result because of the public nature of the university?
I mean, they can say it's a personnel matter, and those can be kept private. We'll see if more comes out. I think the backlash just from faculty alone, maybe they'll feel like they have to respond more, but they can just, you know, say it's a personnel issue and they're not going to comment about it.
Maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke on that part, on the public entity front of that, sticking with that idea. The U of U gets taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
Can they not reveal their decision-making process here?
Right. They as Alex mentioned, they have a lot of latitude when it comes to personnel matters to not disclose information, especially, you know, information about the decision-making process. And so, yeah, I mean, it's possible that they will use that protection to try to shelter or prevent the release of some of this information. But I also think that, as Alex mentioned, that because of the profile of this, because of the way it's been handled and the outcry from faculty and staff about the firing and the way it was handled, I think they're probably going to have to be a little bit more transparent than they might otherwise be, and I think they're going to have to take some steps to try to put this back together. I mean, it's one of those things where it couldn't really possibly have been handled any worse than it was, particularly on the Huntsman end when they were talking about making a major gift to the institute, and another major gift. I think they were talking about $250 million in a new donation that was being discussed, and then for the university to handle this so badly and jeopardize that, I think is really just pretty egregious.
What happened? I mean, were we aware of friction between the university and the Cancer Institute, the Cancer Research Hospital, before this happened, or between Lee and Huntsman, or for that matter, between Lee and Beckerle prior to this news getting out there?
That isn't really clear. I think, you know, when I was talking to Peter, he mentioned, you know, there was in this agreement, there was a portion of it that said, you know, they just about how, like, oversight of the funds, you know, making sure that they go where they're supposed to go. But, you know, he said that that wasn't a concern. No one was concerned with that part of it. So it's, like, really not clear where this is coming from at this point.
You mentioned, you know, the deal in the works between the University of Utah and the Huntsman Cancer Foundation, $130 million. Robert mentioned maybe other money there. What happens to Huntsman Cancer Institute if they don't have their Huntsman benefactors? And, we should point out, I suppose, that the Salt Lake Tribune is owned by a Huntsman, for full disclosure here.
Good call.
John Huntsman Sr. seems to be taking a very hard line on this. Could this be really detrimental to the operating costs of Huntsman Cancer Institute?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, their cancer foundation is responsible for about a third of the budget. I mean, that's a lot. So it could potentially be problematic. The other money that Gerke was talking about is debts that they have already committed to paying off, which about $120 million because of, you know, like the expansion that's set to open in June, I believe. So they've said that we're paying that. You know, that was already agreed to, but I don't know. I don't know what would happen if they pulled out.
You know, I'm trying to think about, you mentioned also a lawsuit or lawsuits that John Huntsman Sr. said that he was threatening against the University of Utah. And this had more to do with, from my understanding of your reporting, with financial dealings at the university, not so much to do with the firing of Mary Beckerle. You could imagine that lawsuit maybe not happening if it weren't for this uproar. But essentially, the only thing we've heard from the university on this is no comment, right? I mean, for why this happened.
Well, for why, yeah. Just that, you know, they put a lot of thought into this. Board of Trustee leadership was involved. but very, very vague.
I'm going to remind our listeners that they can join this conversation with calls and thoughts. The number to call is 801-355-8255. Questions and comments is probably the way to put it. 801-355-TALK, or you can comment at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. And make your pledge. Boy, I'm sorry, I'm in pledge drive mode. Listeners, I'm sorry about that. But so, you know, Beckerle's been let go, I'm assuming there would be some sort of nationwide search for a replacement if under normal circumstances. But given the protests and protests from people like John Huntsman Sr., you can't help but wonder if the University of Utah isn't rethinking their decision. But I guess we'll only know when we know if they decide to make any changes in this decision.
I mean, John seems pretty adamant that she's going to be back in that position. I think it's important to note they've kept her on as a professor, but they fired her from her job as CEO and director of the Institute. But John is pretty adamant that she's going to be back. We'll see.
No. And there was a petition that was circulated by faculty, that's listed as being posted by faculty from the University of Utah at change.org to reinstate her, essentially, right?
Yes. Last time I checked, there was like 1,600 signatures. But there's probably more now. People are very upset. I talked to some professors faculty members, whatever, who said, you know, if she leaves, I leave. She's very beloved in that institute, and I think it's going to cause problems.
And I think that's that could be the more, from the university's perspective, from Vivian Lee's perspective, the threat of faculty and researchers walking away, I think, is probably as pressing as the financial loss if the Huntsmans. Are threatening to pull out or to withhold some financial support. I think because they have spent a lot of time and effort building up this research staff that they've got there. But, you know, I mean, what this boils down to is the campus politics at the University of Utah and any college like this, it's like makes Game of Thrones look weak. I mean, there's been this tension between upper campus and lower campus and the medical and research facilities and the main university for years and decades, even when I was going there. And so it's sort of heightened as this has become a higher stakes game.
Well, we've got a comment here from a listener who called in, didn't stay on the line. This is Laurel in Salt Lake City, who said, essentially, why can't the university fire someone if that person is doing a bad job? They didn't stay on the line to ask this question, but I'm wondering, I mean, do we know of performance? Again, this gets back to me, to the public nature of the institution. Is there some sort of, you know, paper trail of a poor performance being done on the part of Beckerle?
So I actually did a big profile on Mary not that long ago, and there isn't. I mean, that I know of. You know, she's well respected. Like I said, she was on the Blue Ribbon panel for Biden's cancer moonshot. You know, she's on all kinds of panels related to cancer research, and so it's not clear that there's this like trail of bad performance. It's just not. The evidence isn't necessarily there, at least publicly available. So,
and Alex, as a reporter, the information that you're waiting for now is maybe trying to figure out the reason for the firing, but also kind of what happens next with Mary Beckerle.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a lot still to cover on the show, but I want to go to another break before we move on. We've got some not so good news about air quality coming up, but let's do take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and on Utah Public Radio statewide. We'll be right back.
Next time on Ask Me Another, Cameron Esposito tells us why on earth she would marry another comedian.
Because I want my life to be a living nightmare. I want to be with somebody that's a little bit challenging, especially now that my marriage is legal. It's like, what am I going to spend the rest of my time fighting for? You know what I mean?
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
The growing battle over immigration in this country.
Authorities arrested dozens and dozens of undocumented immigrants.
Hundreds of undocumented immigrants were arrested this week across the nation in what authorities insist are routine law enforcement operations.
Utah Public Radio is starting a new series on immigration, and we want to know what you think.
please fill out our survey at upr.org and become a source for our reporting.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Alex Stuckey, Thomas Burr, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. I want to turn now to a couple of stories on air quality, and Emma Penrod, environment reporter, the American Lung Association is giving failing grades to the Salt Lake City metro area. That includes Provo and Orem for ozone pollution and for particulate pollution. For ozone, though, things have apparently worsened here. Maybe start with that part of this report. What does it say about ozone in our region?
Yeah, so this report comes out every year. And we've been on the list of the worst areas in the nation for particulate pollution for quite a while. So that situation remains more or less unchanged. Some years we go a little up, some years we go a little down, but that's the way it's been. Ozone, however, is a sort of a new development. This is the worst ranking Salt Lake City has ever received in this report, to be ranked the 20th in the nation for the worst ozone pollution. And when they say worst, what they mean is they go in and they look at the number of days that that area has violated the EPA's health-based standards related to that pollutant. So Salt Lake City is the 20th worst area in the nation now for number of days on which the ozone levels are unhealthy.
And ozone is formed when essentially car pollution, some forms of pollution, but car pollution in particular, is broken up by sunlight. What are the effects, the health effects, environmental effects of ozone pollution?
Yeah, it's not actually a breaking up of pollutants. It's actually and car emissions produce some of these what they call precursor pollutants. They're the largest source of them, but they come from many sources. And then when these certain pollutants get into the air and there's a chemical reaction that combines them when sunlight, it triggers this chemical reaction that creates the ozone. And ozone is, it's not necessarily a problem if it's in the ozone layer, which I know many people are familiar with,
right.
But that's very high up in the atmosphere. This is ground level ozone that you're able to inhale. And when you inhale the ozone, it effectively burns the inside of your lungs, which can result in irreversible damage that each time you have this happen to your lungs gets a little bit worse and a little bit worse. It's generally associated with respiratory illnesses like asthma and the like.
And particularly bad for children, I think.
Yes.
Dangerous for children.
Yeah, because they have the potential to be exposed more, as well as being, their respiratory system is still developing.
And so you mentioned the time frame, the number of days where we had, poor air quality on ozone. What is that the result of? Why do we have more poor air quality ozone days?
Well, there's probably a number of factors that go into that. Obviously, if you don't have sunlight, you don't have the catalyst for this reaction. So it's a sunny area. We live in a desert. It's warm. We enjoy that climate in the summer, but that's part of that. It has been speculated that possibly global warming could play a role here. The warmer it gets, the more sunny days we have, the more ozone we have. That's how the theory goes. There's also an element just of you don't get ozone if the precursor pollutants aren't present. So you need to have those things in the air, and that's, again, associated with, car emissions primarily, but it can come from your house, it can come from industry.
Well, I want to actually bring that up because in the article you wrote on this topic, you quote, you say that Bryce Bird, who is the director of the Division of Air Quality, says that some amount of this pollution is blowing in from elsewhere. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. There have been studies that indicate that this pollution, yes, may be based maybe coming from places west of here. The worst ozone in the nation is known to be from the L.A. area, and there is some indication that some of those precursors may actually be traveling with the prevailing winds as they do into areas in Utah. Some of the evidence for this is the fact that there are rural areas in Utah that are struggling with, unusually high levels of ozone that aren't really related to the pollutants they're emitting there locally.
Oh, really? In some parts. Mm-hmm.
But it's most likely a combination of things. It's most likely that there's not just one thing.
Sure.
That, you know, there was a factory that suddenly opened up and created a lot of ozone. That's probably not how it works.
But so those precursor pollutants would blow in, but, you know, the ozone wouldn't be formed in the spot where they first existed in, say, the L.A. basin?
It doesn't necessarily have to work that way. You just need to have the precursor pollutants present plus sunlight. Hmm. And an interesting thing there, some of these, you know, one of the key precursors is a set of chemicals known as volatile organic compounds.
Mm-hmm.
The largest source of those things is actually plants. So
decaying plants, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, and just, you know, some plants emit certain, you know, chemicals and things. So yeah, there's biological natural sources of these things as well, and so it's kind of tricky. Interestingly, the precursors for ozone are very similar to the precursors that produce the secondary PM2.5 that we deal with in Utah. So there could be some relationship there.
Well, I want to get to that. The ozone we think of largely as a summertime phenomenon in Salt Lake City, at least, because I know that that's not uniform across the state, and that it can appear in the winter elsewhere. But in the winter we look at the PM2.5, that particulate pollution, and bad rankings for us as well there in this report. Can you lay out the health consequences of ozone? Maybe you could give us some of the health consequences of this particulate pollution.
Yeah, particulate is actually little tiny particles. That's actually what it is. And they're very, very, very small, like, you know, many times smaller than the width of a human hair. And because they're so small, when you inhale them, they travel deep down into your lungs, and there's some evidence to suggest they may even enter your bloodstream. So, you know, ozone, it stays in your lungs. It causes lung damage. Particulate matter has been associated with asthma, as well as heart attacks, strokes, low birth weight. It's thought to have very wide-sweeping effects in the human body.
For both ozone and for PM2.5, actually, let me first remind our listeners that they can join us with thoughts and comments. The number to call is 801-359-5279, or you can go to sltrib.com and make your comments at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live there. But for both of these, ozone, PM2.5, what is the state, what are state regulators, what are politicians doing to address the problems that we have here?
Well, as some of you are probably aware, because we have struggled with the PM2.5 problem for so long, that's, for those who don't know, that's what happens during our inversions. That's PM2.5.
Mm-hmm.
That problem has had us be designated a non-attainment area by the EPA. A non-attainment area is a geographic area that does not meet federal requirements for that particular pollutant. The EPA has these standards. If you don't meet the standard, then effectively the area in which you live is breaking the law, which is, you know, a little ambiguous because it's the air that's breaking the law, but that's how it works. And when you become a non-attainment area, the EPA says, you must now, as state regulators, create a plan to address this pollution problem. And if in a couple of years you haven't met that new standard, then you're going to have more, you know, the consequences. Sort of, we'll take away your autonomy. We'll start, making more choices for you. And so that's what's happening on the PM2.5 front. We have been a non-attainment area for many years at this point. And the EPA has proposed to, because we missed the last deadline, designate Salt Lake City as a serious non-attainment area, which is similar in that, the EPA comes out and says, okay, your last plan did not work. You need a new plan now because you haven't, met the goal. It also, the EPA will come in and say, okay, because the last plan didn't work, now we're going to tell you how you're going to regulate certain industries, and you're going to have to do this, and you're going to have to do that.
Well, I'd love to see what are the plans currently in place requiring of us as citizens or as residents of this area to do, or industry to do, to try and fix this right now?
Well, industry, they all have operating permits that allow them to release a certain amount of emissions. It's individual to their permit what those limits are. And if they violate that permit, there's usually fines, penalties associated with, emitting more than they were given in their permit, those things are usually tied to the state implementation plans, and there will be new permits that will be going out with the serious non-attainment SIP.
Okay.
As far as individuals go, that's a little trickier. But, you know, one thing that has happened is the state has barred the sale of certain water heaters that emit certain pollutants that contribute to these problems. You won't be able to buy those at your local store anymore.
Also, prohibitions on burning.
Prohibitions on burning. When they ask you, when there's a designated mandatory action is what they call it, when you cannot burn solid fuel, you know, not in your fireplace, not outdoors in a fire pit. Except now if you're cooking food.
Right, there's an exemption from this last year's legislative session, this year's legislative session. I want to bring Robert Gerke, columnist, in on this. Robert, the air quality problem here in our region doesn't seem to be going away, and it seems like action beyond what is being done might be needed, both on the part of policymakers, regulators, and the public. What is it going to take to make that kind of change happen?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a complicated and complex problem, and one that we've talked about on the show before, the state legislators in particular are not eager to do anything prescriptive or, you know, that might be, you know, they don't want to pass mandates that are going to, you know, they see impede business or, you know, economic development. So it kind of ties your hands. You're looking basically then at offering incentives, things for like electric vehicles, which they didn't extend again this year, and rooftop solar, which they didn't extend again this year. I mean, they did extend, but they're phasing it out. And so, you know, in some ways, this past session, they actually took some steps backward, I think. And you know, the one upside, I guess, is that we see now Chevron is going to start making Tier 3 gasoline, which would make a pretty significant difference along the Wasatch Front, since the biggest contributor is tailpipe emissions. You know, they but again, this is something that is, you know, there are tax incentives for Chevron to be doing this gasoline, but this is something that the federal EPA mandated that they do. And so you know, you can only go so far with these voluntary compliance things and people trying to clean up on their own. And at some point, you've got to impose mandates and you've got to have, you know, bars that they have to, you know, clear. And this Tier 3 that we're starting to see come online is an example of that.
And I want to ask Emma Penrod about that. This is Chevron producing Tier 3 gasoline. It's a sort of, I guess, cleaner gasoline. Does that cut back on the pollution they're emitting in the refining process? And then also, does it mean that cars here in our region will now be on Tier 3 fuels?
So it won't change the emissions at the refinery necessarily. What it does is, this is a fuel that when you run it through your car produces about 10% fewer emissions because of what's in the fuel. And you know, so it would be available at your local, you know, gas station if they're selling Chevron gas, or Tesoro, because Tesoro has also agreed to do this. And it's expected that maybe other refineries will come online as well. So that will, you know, if you put that gas in your car, it will make your car somewhat cleaner. It's meant to be coupled with a sister Tier 3 auto emissions regulation, which it will cap it caps the amount of emissions that can come out of a car at a certain level, and coupled with that could reduce auto emissions by 70-80% if, you know, everyone were to adopt those cars, and that's mandatory for cars model year 2017 and later.
And this will essentially amount to there being a reduction in, you know, in vehicles on the road, in terms of, you know, looking at what we have today versus what we have in a few years' time when everybody's running on these fuels. Will that make a dent in our poor air quality?
It is anticipated that it will. I've talked with Bryce Bird, and he says their models suggest that it may actually bring all areas in the state into attainment except for the Salt Lake City area, which may have to look at some additional cuts in order to make the current standards. And it's worth noting, too, that it has been proposed that there be several non-attainment areas created for ozone now as well.
What about growth, just population growth in terms of number of people on the road, too? Well, that'll probably play into this as well.
And that is the reason why it's anticipated that the Salt Lake City metro area may not meet the standard just with the new cleaner vehicles and cleaner fuels. They're thinking that growth there will outpace that and that they're going to have to find cuts to come from some other area.
I mean, it is a big deal. Like you mentioned, the growth, if we just look at the growth curve and we didn't do anything to bend that curve, we're going to be going in a direction that's unsustainable, I think, in terms of air quality. So the Tier 3 gasoline does bend that growth curve, but it doesn't necessarily reverse it to the point that we would like to see. But it is a big deal, and probably a bigger deal, and probably in terms of a single thing that is going to be making a change, probably the biggest that we'll see in quite a while.
Well, you would think that public transportation would have a role to play here, and maybe deep discounts in public transportation. Is that, I don't know. I mean, I know I'm throwing out regulatory suggestions, but...
yeah, I mean, the expansion of public transit is one of the things that they also point to as helping to move all of those people that are coming to Salt Lake Valley, helping move those people around in a way that is not going to be detrimental to the air quality.
Okay, guys, we are low on time here, and so Emma Penrod, thanks very much for this reporting, but we've got to turn to our underplayed stories of the week at this point, and so we can do that right now. Is anybody ready with an underplayed story of the week? Emma Penrod, for example.
I have one. Another kind of pollution Southern Utah is trying to combat in the news this week is light pollution. So this is when you have so many lights in an urban area, those in Salt Lake I'm sure notice this, that you can't see the night sky anymore, that you can't see the stars in the night sky. And there's some small towns that have started noticing this development in their area, and they're unhappy about this. They would like to be able to see those stars because it's part of their quality of life. It also is a draw for tourism down there. So they have been implementing some ideas, you know, putting like caps on street lights and those kinds of things to try to curb this trend. So that story's from earlier this week. It's not a super new story, but it's still available on the website if it interests anyone.
Emma Penrod story talking about stars, whatever those are. Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
You know, this is the latest blunder out of Mayor Biskupski's office, but they announced last week the hiring of a new RDA director. An attorney named Mark Woolley, and then promptly rescinded the offer after it came to light that he had, I guess, been terminated or had questions raised about his conduct when he was working in Philadelphia. You know, and it's just, once again, I guess maybe they didn't think to Google before they made the job offer, but I think we're having a recurring Biskupski's Blunders segment on the show. I think we're getting to that point.
Okay, Robert Gerke there with his comment. Alex Stuckey, your underplayed story of the week.
This maybe isn't quite as newsy as theirs, but we had a story earlier this week about the Utah organ donor registry. That's been around for 15 years now, and it just sort of helps a hospital sort of connect donors with people who need organs, and I think it's up to like 1.6 million people that are in the registry. So yeah,
growth in the number of people involved in or wanting to donate their organs. That's an interesting story from Alex Stuckey and Tommy Burr. Assuming you're still on the line, do you have an underplayed story of the week there, Tommy?
Sure. With all the news coming out of Washington, I assume some people have heard about this, but in case you haven't, the Congress has not passed a budget, and at the end of next week, the federal government doesn't have a budget. So we're looking down that pathway towards a possible shutdown again. Usually they avert that with some last-minute deals, but the concern this time around is that President Trump's meddling in this might actually hurt the negotiation process and could end up with another shutdown like we had in 2013.
Okay, possible pending government shutdown from Thomas Burr there for his pick. For mine, I'm going to go with a story written by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller about Desiree Turner. She's the 14-year-old girl who was released from the hospital this week, 9 weeks after she was shot in the head and left to die in a canal. The Tribune article shows her smiling with her mom, and she's got this great quote, which is, I told my dad that I'm tougher than a bullet, which I think is an amazing and inspiring quote, and inspiring words from a 14-year-old shooting victim. That's the survivor, Desiree Turner, and you can find it at sltrib.com. I want to thank Thomas Burr, Emma Penrod, Alex Stuckey, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, for joining us on Behind the Headlines this morning. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
We will wrap up this morning with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and today Kirby talks about resurrection. Robert Kirby, you got to thinking about the concept of resurrection not that long ago. The idea that we'll all rise up at the end of the world, part of the doctrine of more than one faith. But you wondered about how that might go, kind of a ghoulish thought experiment. And in particular, you thought about a great-grandfather you had who had a bit of a feud with another early inhabitant of Salt Lake City. And before we get into what his resurrection might look like, maybe first tell us this bit of genealogy in your family, because it's kind of fascinating.
Oh, yes. My genealogy, like the genealogy of a lot of Mormons, is very colorful thanks to polygamy and relocation and that sort of thing. And I had a grandfather who I fictitiously refer to as Korihor Kirby, and talked about a time when he believed that one of his plural wives was being courted by someone else, and so he found the guy and shot him a bunch of times. The guy didn't die, but the irony is that they're not buried all that far from each other in the same cemetery, like within a stone's throw.
The guy who shot the guy, I mean the grandfather.
My grandfather who shot the guy, okay. And the guy who got shot.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, what's going to happen on the day of the resurrection when people stand up, supposedly right out of their graves and are made whole again? And would that enmity continue? Because one of the things churches do is they give you a nugget of information, but not enough to really figure out what's actually going to happen.
Right. Well, maybe unknowable from our mortal perspective.
Kind yes, of right.
Is the easy way out. But you you also kind of wondered about people who didn't leave that beautiful corpse, who had fingers removed and ears missing and things like that. How are they going to fare in the resurrection?
Well, Mormon doctrine teaches that we'll all be resurrected with perfect bodies. Well, what does perfect mean, and who gets to decide that? If we're all resurrected into a uniform body, are we all going to look alike, and how will we tell each other apart? Or is it left to us, and what sort of adjustments will we make that cause the same problems they cause here on Earth?
Perfect by whose standard, and at what age are questions that you ask in the
comments? Right.
Yeah.
Perfect at the age of 80? No, I don't think so.
Again, maybe if you're a believing person, this is just something you can't know.
Right, and therefore is worth exploring, even on a satirical level.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. And that does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. And thanks as well to you for listening in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or however you get your podcasts. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM, and on Twitter, we are at KCPW. Coming up next on KCPW, it's KCPW Presents and a look at President Donald Trump's strategy in the Middle East from America Abroad. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much for joining us. A quick reminder to listeners of this station that we are working to close out our spring fundraising goal, and you can help us with your pledges of support. We would love to hear from you. And you can do that at kcpw.org. Don't forget to support Utah Public Radio as well. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Roger McDonough. See you next week.
I was 45, and he was 29. We met in a French medieval village called Bruniquel, and after 4 days of debate, I decided to go out with him. I couldn't resist him.
Join us for true stories from women around the world. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
A longtime supporter of the arts in northern Utah, Manon Kane Russell, passed away recently. Along with her surviving husband, Dan Russell, Manon provided numerous scholarships to students in the USU Kane College of the Arts through the generosity of the Marie Eccles Kane Foundation Russell family. Manon's long-lasting relationship with Utah State University institutions such as the Fry Street Quartet Residency and Utah Public Radio will be memorable parts of her legacy.
a service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCU Price, and KUSU FM Logan. Heard online at upr.org.